Welcome to another episode of Spread Bites. My name is Sam Mazzarello and I lead content strategy for Global Research. And I'm thrilled to be joined again by Steve Dulig, head of Spreads Research at JP Morgan. And today we have two guests, Nelson Janssen, head of high yield and leverage loan strategy, and Daniel Lamy, head of European credit strategy. Now, Steve just came back from the IMF meetings in Washington and we have a plethora of things to talk about. So Steve, I want to start with you. Last month on our first Spread Bites, we talked about private credit. You went in depth. Let's talk particularly now around something you mentioned last time, which was the vulnerability of credit and risk markets in light of strong growth, persistent inflation, and a Fed that perhaps was changing direction slightly. So given that we've seen Fed repricing happening quite dramatically, I'd say, in terms of less easing this year, have you been surprised about repricing? Tell us your views and thoughts on that dynamic.
Yes, I have been surprised. I mean, I think we concluded our first call by saying that we felt that markets could be vulnerable to pricing less Fed. And to be quite frank, that's pretty much what we've seen over the past month. But you know, the concession that we've seen in pricing, at least in spread terms, has been very, very modest, particularly modest in the context of cash index spreads relative to derivative index level spreads. So, yes, I think surprised by how modest the correction, if we want to call it that, has been. It's really probably more of a concession than a correction. But I think that also reflects something I think we discussed last month, which was that in general, credit market technicals feel quite strong, you know, positioning and in particular the ongoing absorption of issuance in primary markets really suggests that no one's over their skis. Investors either have cash or they continue to receive inflows, which they need to invest. So, yes, surprise, but it feels like technicals continue to remain quite strong overall.
So then let's talk about the IMF meeting specifically. We purposely delayed recording of this until you were back. You obviously spent the week there talking to clients, investors, policymakers. I want to get your sense of general sentiment at the IMF meetings and what was your take there?
I mean, if I had to use a word, I would say investors were fairly, you know, again, against the backdrop of resilient slash robust growth, markets sort of unwinding Fed expectations. I think investors, quite honestly, were, you know, to use one word, fairly sanguine. You know, there's a recognition that, you know, there are certainly some risks out there. But I think right now, you know, the high for long is the consensus narrative. I couldn't find anyone that really was pushing the idea of higher for longer, i.e. that the Fed may need to actually raise rates from present levels. But quite honestly, from a data perspective, probably 3 to 6 months, possibly away from that. So I think everyone in a high for long camp, everyone fairly sanguine. I think people remind mindful of risks, but I think nobody sees anything as either too immediate or too cataclysmic. So, you know, that would be my takeaway in terms of investor positioning and sentiment from the conference.
So if we were to go deeper on private credit again, because we know that's a topic of significant interest to clients and just broadly in the space, you put out a report, you and your team, IMF also put out a report pretty closely spaced together on private credit. Walk us through some of the takeaways from both your report and what we're hearing from the IMF.
Yeah, I mean, the first point is an entire coincidence that we published, I think, within a couple of days of each other. So the IMF actually twice a year publish a global financial stability report. And within that, they included a chapter this time on private credit, exploring some of the potential risks going forward. And I think, you know, to the extent that the IMF report, which we think is actually very detailed and actually has some very good analysis. And quite honestly, we did some of the same things and used some of the same data sources. I think it's very important to be mindful of the sort of IMF's role as this guardian or sentry on macro and financial market risks. So that sort of naturally inclines them to think about potential risks, where I think we probably have explored in the past some of the potential benefits associated with the growth in private credit. I think in terms of the report, you know, a lot of it we agree with, quite honestly. Probably the biggest difference between our report and theirs relates to the potential size of the asset class. And I know we might get into that in a little bit more detail in a moment, but the difference between our number and their number, let's say, it really reflects some of our assumptions around the extent to which we think leverage has been deployed within the asset class. But we can get a bit more granular in a moment on that. But in terms of some of the things which resonated with me, which the IMF explored, we agree with the idea that, you know, asset liability mismatches today aren't very large. And that's very important, you know, to the extent that there are concerned people out there with respect to what's going on, given the growth of private credit. You know, the point that we would make is that financial accidents tend to happen when you have asset liability mismatches. I think they agree that right now those asset liability mismatches aren't large, but the thing which they highlight, and I would agree with, is that if you do have an increasing level of retail participation in the asset class, that can change the dynamics somewhat, not least given that community's preconception of liquidity and transparency might be very different from the, you know, institutional pension funds and insurance companies who've been committing long-term capital to the space. So, you know, certainly retail and the commitments of marginal retail dollars and the growth of retail participation, they highlight and we'd agree is very important from a transformational perspective and possibly a risk perspective. And then I think the other thing which they focused on a little bit is the interconnectedness within the asset class, be it that large private equity firms are also very large direct lenders. Some of those firms have insurance company subsidiaries, which invest actively in the space. And also that part of the growing footprint in credit in Europe, which is driven from the US. So a big focus in interconnectedness and what that might mean if you were to see a more intrusive, let's call it that, an intrusive regulatory approach to the space. So that's kind of, I would say, some of the main sound bites in terms of their report and some of the differences versus ours.
Very interesting. So I heard you say asset and liability mismatch, retail participation, and then the interconnectedness of the asset class. Direct everyone who maybe hasn't seen our piece yet to take a look at that, because like I mentioned, it's been of significant interest to clients. I guess to go deeper then, Steve, on what you mentioned, size of the asset class, dry powder versus what might be deployed. So in your piece, you did do an estimate of the size of the private credit market. Yourself or perhaps Nelson or Daniel, can we walk through that analysis and maybe debunk some of the key myths on what the size is of the global private credit market?
I'll probably defer to Daniel on that, who did most of the heavy lifting in terms of the work.
Sure. Thanks, Steve. So the figures that are frequently cited regarding the size of the private credit market globally is the data from Preqin. And if you look at the latest numbers, that's around about $1.7 trillion. However, when you look at what that contains, there are a few things, firstly, that you might wish to strip out, such as the amount of dry powder, which is capital that has been committed to the asset class but actually hasn't been invested. That's roughly a third of the total. So depending on your point of view, you might want to take that away. But then the data only covers certain types of fund. So it only includes commingled closed-end funds, so typically an LPGP-style fund structure. It doesn't include separately managed accounts. It doesn't include listed and open-ended or evergreen funds. And in particular, we think that their data, Preqin's data, undercounts the amount of assets held by BDCs, business development companies, in the US. We think to the tune of about $225 billion on our estimates. So if you were to add that back in, suddenly you're talking about a much larger total asset base. And then on top of that, Preqin's data is reported on a net basis. So what it does is it strips out or adjusts for any money that is borrowed to leverage the return on these assets. And when you account for that, actually, the total assets could be quite a bit larger than Preqin is reporting. Now, we don't obviously have a lot of data around leverage used for these various funds. We think that in the US, private credit funds use more leverage than they do, say, in Europe, where leverage is much less widely deployed. What we did in our analysis is we assumed a blanket one turn of leverage across the fund universe, just as an indication rather than an estimate. And so if you do the exercise of adding back the BDC figures and then apply one turn of leverage, you can get to, let's say, an upper bound of $2.6 trillion of invested capital, or if you add back dry powder, $3.1 trillion globally.
And I would say that based on some of the feedback we've had, feedback has cut both ways. I think, you know, while we've tried to stress that that 3 trillion number is an upper bound from our perspective, people see it as simply too high. And yet I've also had somebody who thinks that, you know, when you do take factor in leverage, it can very well be 3 trillion. So there's definitely a bid offer on the size of the asset class, but it's something we'll continue to dig into as we sort of improve our own understanding of the data.
And that's actually a perfect segue for us to talk about what we're hearing from clients. We know that generally it's of interest to clients what other clients are asking. So Daniel Nelson, I'm going to turn to you then and say, what have you been getting the most client questions on post-publication of the report? Also, Nelson, I know you've been on the road talking to clients. So what are we hearing?
Sure, I can kick it off here. You know, since it was fresh, there were a lot of discussions around credit fundamentals, so looking at both high yield and leveraged loans. You know, on the high yield side, there was general awareness that the asset class is in a good position, you know, heading into what could be a more challenging earnings stretch ahead. We actually saw leverage come down for the cohort in the fourth quarter as EBITDA was resilient, but also we've seen 0% debt growth. So most of the capital market activity we've been experiencing has been used to term out maturities, and we've seen very little leveraging new issue within the markets. On the loan side, it's benign, but there was an awareness that there is a big gap between the state of balance sheets for both public and private borrowers. So one of the big enhancements we've done in recent quarters is we've added about 500 private companies to the analysis. And underneath, you know, what you see is there's a pretty big gap in terms of, you know, where leverage stands. You know, leverage on the private cohort is around 6 times, you know, versus 4.5 times for the public cohort. And then on a coverage basis, it's much lower, 2 times you know, versus 4.5 times for public companies, or even 1.6 times on an immediate basis. So when you look at it at face value, it's been pretty steady over the course of the Fed's rate hike cycle. But it does highlight underneath that if you do see a slowdown in the economy, as our economists are forecasting in the back half of the year, there could be a cohort of loan issuers, you know, in a higher for rate, higher for longer rate environment that could struggle a bit more as the year progresses. And that kind of feeds into our overall view that if we do see things slow down, that we'll see a little bit more dispersion, you know, around earnings as we move forward.
Especially between public and private.
Exactly.
Okay. Daniel, what about you?
Yeah, in terms of some of the other talking points from the private credit report, so we updated our analysis on total returns for private credit and comparing those with public markets. If you go back to 2014, the average annual return is just over 8%. And that for various different metrics measures of private credit returns, that compares with 4 to 5% annually for dollar high yield bonds and loans over the period. I think what's actually more interesting than that, when we look at returns by fund across various vintages, is actually the very wide dispersion we see in fund returns, even from funds within the same cohort, vintage cohort, which I think stresses the idea that diversification is important for the end investor that is allocating capital to private credit strategies, because when, unlike regular benchmarks, say high yield funds that all track a certain index and will have relatively similar returns most of the time, you can have quite a wide variation in fund returns. We also found that if you look at the IRR of these funds, it tends to start off quite high in the earlier years of the fund's life and then drops toward after a few years as the fund becomes more mature. We can question whether there's some specific one-off events there or whether it's the case that credit losses accrue more slowly and are backloaded. And so that's something to think about when looking at the performance of the asset class. Then we also did a study of performance of private credit funds in the first half of 2020 as the pandemic hit, I think really to challenge the notion that there's no mark to market in private credit, actually, we did find that over 60% of private credit funds reported a loss in the first quarter of 2020, even though at that stage there hadn't really been any fundamental impact from the pandemic into company performance. And then of those funds that didn't report losses in Q1, those subsequently did so, many of them in the second quarter. So I think putting some perspective around the idea that it's a zero volatility or non-mark-to-market asset class.
Let's talk about default rate forecasts. We'll focus on the US, and then Daniel, I'll come back to you for Europe. So Nelson, you already alluded to it, refinancing volumes and activity there. Do you think there's downside risks to your default forecasts? Walk us through your thinking there.
Sure. So our forecast for this year for high yield is 2.75%, and for loans, it's 3.25%. And then we see that stepping up moderately to 3%, 3.75% next year. Probably the best forward indicator of default risk is the distress universe. So if you think about it, coming into 2023, about 10% of leveraged credit was distressed. We've seen that ease. We've seen that ease to less than 6% of leveraged credit. Traditionally, one third of that defaults 12 months forward. So we're definitely seeing the market position itself for slightly less defaults of what we're thinking. I think the big positive development that we've seen is not only are we seeing companies access capital to refinance, but we're seeing activity broaden out. So in particular, we're seeing more B3 hurdle rated issuers tap the markets. And we saw volume north of $100 billion in the first quarter. We haven't done more than $20 billion in a single quarter going back over the past couple of years. So that's a big positive because as we made the turn into this year, the bulk or 40% of the maturity schedule is rated B3 or lower. So we refinanced a lot of the easier credits in 23, and now we're starting to deal with some of the more challenging credits in 24. And that's helping to ease the distress universe and helping to provide a little bit of downside risk around our views for 24.
And the distress universe, like you said, is a nice little heuristic rule of thumb in terms of.
Right. Okay. And that represents bonds trading wide of 1,000 and loans trading below.
Daniel, I know you had been talking about some prominent credit stories in Europe specifically. Do you want to talk high-level thematic for us on that and then also talk about what you're seeing for potential default rates in Europe?
Yes, sure. So our forecast for high-yield default rates is 2.5% for this year, 3% for leveraged loans. If you look at the 12-month trailing figure in the bond market, it's actually slightly ahead. It's 2.6%. But when you look at the year-on-year comparisons, actually, we'd expect that in the next few months to actually drop temporarily, at least below our target. There are, however, as you mentioned, three very sizable companies with very big capital structures in the European high-yield market that alone represent between 2.5% and 3% of the market, which within a very short space of time all announced that they had hired restructuring advisors, which normally is a move that precedes some kind of restructuring or default. Now, if all of those three companies were to default in the second half of this year, say, then that would certainly push the default rate above that 2.5% forecast. However, it seems unlikely that time frame is met. We're still doing some work in terms of when we think restructuring is likely for these companies. And so, most likely, we will put some of that default risk, we'll push that out into future years, possibly next year. And when you step away from those idiosyncratic events, actually, the story in Europe is a little bit better than it seemed in the second half of last year, at least in terms of the macro economy. We've seen a recovery in the high frequency data. Today's flash PMIs actually took another leg upwards, and particularly on the services side. And the household sector in the Eurozone is sitting on very high levels of savings, and private sector leverage in general is relatively low. So there are a lot of macro reasons to think that default rates aren't going to move to very high levels, I mean, certainly in the nearer term. And it's really much more about these one-off single name credits that could temporarily at least push default rates operates up, but we don't see very large systemic default risks at the moment in Europe.
Okay, as we start to wrap up the conversation, because we've run the gamut of topics, Steve, I do want to ask you about something that you mentioned when you came back from the IMF meetings, that the idea of crowding out in light of government debt dynamics was a topic of interest. Can you just talk us through that concept and perhaps what you heard from the panel that you were on and moderated?
Yes. So crowding out was something that came up quite a bit when we started to engage investors in the latter part of last year with respect to the 2024. You know, the whole idea being that governments continue to run large deficits, debt to GDP ratios have risen. And what did that mean for economies and growth? It read through to corporate cash flows. What might it mean for credit spreads and risk assets if you got into a world where there was a lot of concern about the sustainability of government debt levels? And you know, there are a couple of sessions that I sat through as a spectator at the IMF, because you know, I think when clients asked those questions back in Q4, quite honestly, I didn't have the tools to my hand or had read anything to my hand that would allow me to answer the question on anything other than a qualitative basis. But the estimated effects of crowding out were quite small. So, for example, one of the participants in one of the sessions highlighted that the US debt to GDP ratio had risen 60 points, broadly doubled from 60% of government debt to GDP in 1960 or the early 60s to around 120% today. The net impact of that on the level of GDP was that US GDP was 8 points lower than would otherwise been the case had that debt to GDP ratio remained constant. And 8 percentage points off the level of GDP over 60 years doesn't seem to be quite as big an impact as some of the people that are worried about crowding out might suggest, not least if you amortize it, you know, just divide 8 by 60, you end up with a pretty small number. I think the real risk really relates to some form of political dysfunction and another Liz Truss moment. I guess I can get away from saying that as an Englishman, but that's probably the more concerning thing. I mean, the estimated impacts of crowding out, pure increase in debt to GDP ratio would seem to be quite small. I mean, I take the point that there's probably a lot going on. The US benefits enormously from the fact that the dollar is the reserve currency in the world and attracts a lot of overseas capital. But it was interesting to hear those numbers, just given some of the concerns out there. But from my perspective, you know, sustainability is probably more of a concern. Crowding out is less of a concern than, let's say, political dysfunction, and that giving rise to some kind of Liz Truss-like moment and concerns around stability and sustainability on that basis.
Excellent. So then, Steve, the last question, how we're always going to end spread bites. I'm curious what you think investors should be looking at with respect to credit markets over the next month.
Probably much the same, in all honesty, as where we ended off last month. I mean, I think, obviously, people are going to pore over the next set of inflation data. That's going to be a big focus. You know, I think as much as people are, as I mentioned up front, I think as much as people are in the high for long camp now, I don't think anyone is in the higher for longer camp. That seems to be a sort of an exercise in semantics. But I think there is a big difference between markets which begin to try and probe pricing for higher Fed rates rather than constant or slightly lower Fed rates. But I think we're some way off that. So I guess my takeaway is that the outlook for the next month probably a little bit similar to the outlook for the last month. And basically, given the very modest concession or repricing that we saw, given the, you know, markets pricing less Feds, you know, I think we can continue to take some comfort from what appears to be a very strong technical. I mean, all-in yields remain in an attractive place for institutional investors. Interestingly on that, our colleague Jay Barry who co-runs our US interest rate strategy, thinks that while he's not willing to necessarily get very bullish at current levels, he thinks the scope for high yields from here is quite limited. I would also highlight some of the work from our colleague Saul Doctor. You know, we have a derivative index-based fear and greed indicator, as we call it, and that has typically been very good at identifying local wides and spreads, which it did about a week ago, and spreads have moved tighter somewhat. So where we are is a place where markets have looked a bit oversold and begun to rebound. Technicals are strong. Rates have probably peaked for now. But again, I think, you know, it's the inflation data in the coming month, which is probably going to be key to the overall tone that we see. I think we are a little bit away from pricing a more hawkish pivot. I say touch.
That's a great note to end on. I want to thank Nelson, Daniel, and Steve for their time and insights. And I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in. And we'll see you next time.